Now, we know it's the presidential car. You can see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong.
The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
Are we living in a world filled with conspiracies and supernatural? How could we prove there's a universe just beyond our grasp? This is Rick Wood, host of Audio Martini, paranormal radio with a skeptical eye wide open. Do not go gently into that good night. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rick Wood. Welcome you to Audio Martini. Our guest tonight is Tom Metzger. He's the second guest in our view of racist groups of America. And as opposed to going through a long introduction, I'm going to let Tom introduce himself to the show. Tom, first of all, welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
What is White Aryan Resistance? Explain the organization and what it is that you attempt to do.
Well, actually, White Aryan Resistance was phased out about a year ago. It's now called the Insurgent, but it really stands for the same thing. We are white separatists. We believe in the development and the best interests of the white race, and we believe in racial separation. We believe it's best for all races concerned. I've been working at it for a long time. We do a radio show 7 days a week, and We're an association of independent people. We're not an organization. We don't have membership cards. We don't wear uniforms. We don't have flags. We don't do all that. But we do have associates all over the country and, to a degree, all over the world, promoting the one key issue, the best interest for the white race.
When you say that you don't have an organization and just associates, is that primarily because the Justice Department did such a good job of breaking up separatist organizations basically through the tax law?
No, it's not. That's not the reason. In fact, I haven't been a membership organization since 1980, to be perfectly honest about it, even though Morris Deese was able to convince the court I was an organization. I just believe that the time has come to where we cannot meet safely. We cannot do as we did in the old days, have public meetings, things like that. We believe the time has come where the police state has gotten too invasive, not only with us, with a lot of other people. So we believe in operating as lone individuals or lone wolves in cells and networking. And, of course, with the Internet, that works out quite well. Saves people a lot of money. They don't run all over the country going to meetings. But we found that all the membership organizations are infiltrated, and every time they have try to have a public get-together, they have infiltrators and agitators and mix in with them. And so it's just not worth it.
Now, when you say operation, Tom, that's kind of an interesting phrase, that people should be lone wolves. What is it that they should be doing? When they're promoting the cause of the white race, what specifically should they be doing?
Well, everyone has different talents, because we have everybody from teenagers up until people in their 80s. And even I'm 70, well, almost 70 now. So each person has their own talents and contribute from whatever position they're in. We advise them to keep themselves covert and as secret as possible. And no matter what profession they're in, no matter whether they're in some government office or whether in the military, whether they're in the regular walks of life, to keep their racial feelings secret and network with the associates all over.
But once they network and we allow for everybody's individual talents, let's build, I guess, the perfect Aryan robot here. Everybody, a guy that had all the talents required, what would this person be doing?
Well, he would be advocating the best interests of white people who deserve to be have their interest advocated. At this point, we feel that a tremendous amount of white people in this country, they're not interested, and so we're not interested in them. So the network and the association primarily grows by assisting and protecting each other. And we pretty much cut the rest of them off. If they decide they want to change their ways, fine. Otherwise, they're on their own. Well, we used to say we're all out to save the white race, but there's a lot of white race we can't save.
But you still haven't answered the question there, Tom. And looking back at your career, one thing that you've never been accused of is not being forthright. When I ask you what your folks should be doing when they're trying to promote the white race, what is that specifically?
Well, once they understand what is good for the white people who care they're white in this country, they should be using whatever means they can use to advance that way of thinking. Now, whether that's in activism, writing letters to the newspaper, whether it's going on radio or TV shows, whether it's helping white people out in other ways, it's whatever they're able to do. I'm not a dictator. I don't tell them what to do. I just tell them they should know what they can do to help white people who deserve to be white, you know?
Well, then some of those people who have the talents in ordnance, for instance, and weapons use, should they be using their talents to blow up buildings and murder?
No, but they should be well educated for the possibility of having to do that at some point in the future. At the present time, we operate as a legal, more or less covert association of people, but we also have many people who are retired or active military people, and they're advised to learn as much and be trained as highly as they can, because if it comes to the point where they start shutting us totally down and things go sky high in this country, well, then it becomes a hot war. Right now, it's not a hot war.
What's going to happen to create the hot war, in your opinion, Tom?
Well, the government will do it for us. We won't have to do anything. The government is moving towards suppressing everybody's rights in this country, freedom of speech and so forth. They just passed a bill in Congress, SR 1955, which essentially sets up a commission to go around the country and looking for people who have strange thoughts or dangerous thoughts and like that. So we're very close to a police state in this country.
Okay, and I'm going to go actually to your website, and ladies and gentlemen at home, forgive the sounds of the computer clicking back and forth. For some reason, that got turned on before I went on the air, so bear with me. But you say on your own website that the only rights that people have really are not God-given, they're whatever their strength can provide them.
Yeah, in other words, I don't believe in rights at all. I believe we're granted privileges by the state, and the state could take those privileges away anytime they want. There's no so-called God-given right. That's simply an abstract term that really means nothing.
So, utilizing your same philosophy, then isn't the government justified in flexing their muscle to espouse their philosophy?
And we're justified in flexing ours, just like happened here in 1776.
Or in 1996, when Timothy McVeigh blew up a federal building.
He was trying to make a point, yes.
Was he
don't think the government, if they got the point, didn't admit they got the point. And the public didn't get the point at all.
Was he a patriot, in your opinion?
From his point of view, yeah. Sure he was.
I was asking your opinion, Tom.
I don't pass judgment on an act that a person does or involves themselves in. I realize why he did it, and I can understand why he did it. I understand why a lot of people do a lot of things. That doesn't necessarily mean that I would train him and set him up to do it. But I think he had a legitimate gripe, and I think that probably before this is over, you'll see a lot more government buildings go up.
So back to the question. I wasn't asking you if you would train him to do it. In your opinion, was he a patriot?
Not totally to the race, no, because Timothy McVeigh was not what I would call a white separatist. He was more of a militia-oriented type person. And so, in other words, I never met him. He never wrote to me, never asked me anything. But I understand him, just the same way I understand why the government killed all those people at Waco.
Why did they do that?
Because they had the power to do it.
I see.
And you must develop the power to resist them. If it was up to me, we'd still have the Articles of Confederation. We'd break up the federal government altogether.
Well, it's not just the power to resist, though, isn't it? It's the power to overthrow, in your opinion.
Well, they overthrow the people's privileges, so the people have a right to defend themselves, no matter who they are.
But
the government's run by transnational corporations. The politicians are nothing but pawns. The sovereign government of the United States has been gone for a long time.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Audio Martini. Our guest tonight is Tom Metzger, head of White Aryan. It's not resistance anymore. What is it? Insurgent?
The insurgent.
And he's a self-confessed racist. As a matter of fact, you don't have a problem with that term, do you, Tom?
Of course not. I'm proud of it.
What is a racist specifically?
A racist is one who considers the best interests of his race, same as his family. His race is his extended family, and he's going to do everything he can to protect that race and advance its cause, no matter what it is. And every race should do the same thing. Black separatists, they do it, and I respect that. Asian separatists do it. I respect that. That's natural.
Is there one race that's superior to the other, in your opinion?
Well, that's a long-range type struggle. It's a game that keeps going on, and Mother Nature ultimately decides that. Up until a few decades ago, the white race was doing quite well, considering it is the minority race in the world. It has developed a lion's share of technology, medicine, art, all the things like that, if you look in the encyclopedias. And so it was superior for a long time, but it's losing its superiority now.
Well, you're not a religious man, per se, are you, Tom?
No, I'm not.
So you don't think that there is any God selected?
Well, I'm an atheist. Well, I don't have to prove it one way or the other. I'm an atheist. And
well, I am too, but my question was this, Tom. You don't feel that then there is someone selected by a divine being to be the master race?
No, I believe it's totally evolutionary and natural. It's a struggle among the races, a struggle among individuals, survival of the fittest, if you will.
Let's ask you to take us on a little tour of your history, Tom, because it's interesting to me how a man gets to your position. And you've been far more notable in the past than perhaps right now, but I'm sure that the Southern Poverty Law Center has a lot to do with that. How did you begin this track? Tell us a little something about where you grew up. Was it predominantly white neighborhood? Was it predominantly black neighborhood? Was it rural? Give us some flavor there.
I was born and raised in Warsaw, Indiana. Went to school here, joined the Army here, and came back here.
Well, Warsaw, Indiana is pretty lily white, isn't it?
It still is, yeah. It's however, there's a lot of illegal aliens running around here now, more than I like, but... it was almost all white. I think it was only one black family in the town when I was growing up.
And then you left there. And so, well, what? There was no racism there, really, was there? Because there were.
Well, when you have a homogenous race of people, there's no need to be racist. Racism is a defense mechanism that nature gives us to protect ourselves as a race. And so, if you're living in an all-white area, an all-white country, an all-white state, you don't need racism. So because there's nobody to be racist against.
So you leave Indiana and head for the Army. There wasn't a stop in college along the way, I take it.
No, not till I got out of the Army. I went to Europe, was over there for 3 years in the military, worked in electronics, and then I came back. I spent a couple of years in Warsaw, and then I went to California, worked for Douglas Aircraft in the missile industry.
The period in the Army, that's really where the seeds of the racism started, wasn't it?
It was slow, but it did, I think, because when I was sent down to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and was confronted with the massive numbers of blacks from South Chicago, it was a real eye-opener, I'll tell you that.
You didn't get your ass kicked, did you, Tom?
No, I've never had my ass kicked by a black man.
Okay, so what began...
I've had my ass kicked by a white man.
But what began this virulent racism then? I mean, okay, so you see black people, but what was the behavior that started you down the path?
I don't think my racism is so virulent. I'm not a white supremacist in the sense of oppressing black people. All I want is separation. I don't want them to be a slave to me. I don't want to oppress them. I wish them the best in their own country, their own territory. I think I'm very liberal in many ways. At least I'm not doing it for money like the capitalists did. They used racism to oppress people, and they weren't serious racists. They just used it as a weapon. I'm not like that. I don't want to oppress these people. I don't. In my day-to-day dealings, I don't have any problems with black people.
Well, you weren't always that way, and we're going to eventually get to your Ku Klux Klan period, but...
Well, I was that way then. I didn't hurt anybody when I ran the Klan. We were racial separatists then.
Well, then you separated yourself from an awful large portion of the Klan, but we'll get there. And trust me, we've got an hour to spend together,
sure.
So we'll get there. But what
okay.
was the behavior that you saw in the Army, Tom, that made you pick up such a dislike of black people?
Well, it didn't start there, but the observation that I made, my racism came from observation, not from being beaten or robbed. And I watched the way blacks operated, and especially when there's a lot of blacks all together. In the Army, I noticed that if we had one or two black people in the outfit, we didn't have any problem at all. But if you get very many of them in there, things start going to hell.
Like what?
Laziness, AWOL, you're picking on me because I'm black, all that kind of stuff.
Is that true of Africans as well?
You mean in Africa?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. I haven't been to Africa, so I'm not sure. I do know they do a lot of eating of each other and things like that.
Actually, that's really not the case. That's pretty... Well, I hate to say
Idi Amin killed his mother-in-law and cut her up and put her in his freezer.
Well, Joe Stalin killed over 6 million people, so yes.
Well, he killed a lot more than that. Him, okay. Along with the Jews that helped him, they killed probably 30 million with his Jewish henchmen.
Okay, so I think we'll agree that there are plenty of nuts to go around, but I don't think Idi Amin...
Well, he didn't eat them. I don't think Stalin ate them.
Is that the difference? So one lunatic is superior to another because he didn't ingest them. Is that it?
No, they're just two different types.
Well, because
both may be criminals, but they're two different types.
Who was our boy in New York a few years ago that would ingest all of his homosexual lovers? What was his name?
Was that Dahmer?
Yeah, Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey's a white guy, eats people. As a matter of fact, most of the cannibalism that you see in the United States is white people. So the phrase
yeah,
that
but
they
it's
do...
Nothing, it's nothing compared to the cannibalism in Africa.
And upon what do you base that statement, Tom?
Because
you said
you've
never been there. So.
I listen and watch the BBC all the time, listen to what's going on in Kenya, and then the big deal with the Tutsis here, where a million people were killed in one afternoon
and they're not ingesting each other. What they're doing actually is they're engaging in race hate, aren't they? And now, of course, they are doing it from a different perspective.
It's tribalism.
Yes.
It's tribalism.
Which is primarily what you are aspires.
I believe in tribalism too. Not only do I believe in the white race, I believe that in tribalism among whites. If the people, whites in the South, want to operate the way they want to operate, that's fine with me. And the whites in the North want to operate the way they want to operate, or the ones in Indiana want to operate a different way. As long as they don't screw the race up, operate any way you want.
So
I'm sort of a racial. I'm a racial libertarian.
A racial libertarian. Well, yeah. then tell me how you developed that, because once you went to the Army and you saw all of these the downside of being around blacks, then you left the Army. How long was it before you joined the Klan?
Well, I went to California first. I worked from 1961 till 1964. Joined the John Birch Society out there. Worked on the Apollo space shot. I did that, which I never get credit for.
What did you do there?
I worked in the Primary Standards Electronics Laboratory that took care of all the equipment on the shots and all the missile shots in the South Pacific and all that.
What is the John Birch Society? Because that's something that I've heard of in the periphery, but I've never really understood it.
Well, it was a pretty strong outfit back in the late 50s, early 60s, or in the 60s. It's a right-wing, basically anti-communist group. It wasn't ostensibly racist, even though I did meet racists that were in the John Birch Society, but they were not tolerated if they talked about it. I was not a racist at that time, even though I saw differences between the races in the Army and Fort Leonard Wood and other places. That didn't mean I turned racist. I was not a racist at the time I went to California. And then I moved from L.A. and quit Douglas Aircraft and went down to Fallbrook, California, got back in the John Birch Society, 1968. Then I quit the John Birch Society because I quit paying taxes for the Vietnam War, much more than most liberals did to resist the war. IRS seized my house. I finally got it back, and then gradually I started meeting with more radical people that were involved in the tax rebellion around the country, and among those people were racists. And then at about 1975, I met David Duke, who gave a speech down in San Diego, and I went to talk to him the next day and decided to join his Klan.
Well, now,
so I became...
When you joined the Klan, I mean, it wasn't like you slapped your forehead and said, I should have been a racist, like it was a V8 moment when you heard the David Duke speak.
No, I was already a racist by that time.
Okay, so where, because you had mentioned in the Army that there were a lot of traits that you didn't like among black people, but where did you say, hey, I've got to do something about this?
Another step along the way was the Watts riots. I lived only a few miles from the Watts riots, and of course they were burning down the town, and people were dying all over the place, and things got hot. And then, of course, they come across with the Run for Fair Housing Bill. It's in California law. You had to sell your house to whoever had the money, and you couldn't not sell it to a black. And I said, you know, this has become ridiculous. So I think more than anything else, the government turned me into a racist more than anything else.
When you first heard David Duke speak, what did he say that lit the light bulb for you?
He said, it's time for us to develop a professional Klan. It's time for us to wear business suits. It's time for us to start fighting back, run for office, and gain some power. And since no other group that I saw was doing that, I said, that sounds like a good idea to me. And so I joined and then ultimately ran for Congress and the U.S. Senate and like that.
Well, how long were you in? First of all, what was the name of the clavern of David Duke's organization?
The Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
And tell me how you began your career there. Obviously, you don't start off as second in command.
It was pretty fast, I'll tell you that, because they didn't have much leadership. They had a lot of potential members, but they didn't have much leadership in California, so it wasn't but a year or so till I took the job. But ultimately, I left David Duke and just ran an independent Klan in California from 1977 to 80, and that's when I ran for Congress, and after I ran for Congress, I quit the Klan.
What kind of man was David Duke? Describe him for us.
Well, David Duke was a very articulate young man. I worked on his campaign for state assembly back in 77, I think it was. Very articulate, very intelligent, fairly well educated, and he was going great guns, but he had some problems too, and so that sort of...
What were those problems?
Unfortunately, he was a womanizer. He got in the way of his politics. And there's a few other things that he did that I couldn't go along with. He wrote one book called African Etoto, which it was a book allegedly written by a black man on how to kill white people, a black radical. And then he wrote a book.
Was it presented as fiction, or did he present it as like the
presented like a handbook how to kill white people?
So he wasn't a novel. He tried to use it as a way to create a wedge between whites and blacks. Is that what I'm hearing?
I guess so. That's what he says. I say that I think it was an immoral thing to do. But anyhow, he wrote a book then ostensibly written by a girl telling women how to make their husbands happy or the boyfriends happy. And it's stuff like that and the womanizing that I couldn't take.
Well, the womanizing is certainly not something that brought his downfall. I mean, frankly, the Klan, whose reputation, at least before that, had been stringing people up, blowing up churches and that sort of thing, as long as you're not dallying with a boy, I wouldn't think that would have hurt his career.
Well, there was nobody hanging anybody or killing anybody when we were involved, either Duke or I. He left about the...
Understood. But that's not the history of your organization. And so all I'm saying, Tom, is that him dallying with a woman or two is nothing compared to the history of that organization. So,
well, my problem with my problem was he was trying to mess around with members' wives and things and daughters, and that was not – I wasn't going to put up with that.
How long did he continue as head of the Klan after you left, Tom?
It wasn't but about a year, I think, after I left.
He ran for national office at one point, did he not?
No, he ran for, what was it, governor or senator there, state senator, I believe, in Louisiana. He became the state senator, state assemblyman, or one of those kind of offices. And then he was going to run for governor. I believe it was governor, and he lost out there.
How did he make the transition from California to Louisiana?
Well, that's where he was born and raised. He never lived in California.
I see.
He came to California on a speaking tour. He went on the, I'm trying to remember the talk show, Tom Snyder Show. He made a big hit on the Tom Snyder Show, and Tom Snyder almost never lived it down because he really did a good job.
Well, I've actually always been an admirer of Tom Snyder because Tom would talk to anybody he found interesting, and I kind of patterned the show somewhat after that. Quite honestly, normally, Tom, I don't have Nazis and white separatists in the house, but I'm glad to have him on the show, and I'm sure you feel the same way.
No problem with me, but I like Tom, too. I got along quite well with Tom. In fact, I was on his show later on, a few years later after Duke, and we got along fine. In fact, I got along with a lot of the big television talk show people.
Well, you're probably good for ratings. Anytime you can get a guy who's a kluxer, people want to see that. Okay, now.
Well, what I supported more was the original Klan against the government more than the Klan against the blacks. See,
I'm not going to let you get away with that, Tom. That's
well,
okay.
I'm telling you what I did. Telling you what I did. I'm not going to say what a lot of them did. In fact, that's one of the reasons I left the Klan. I said, we don't have time fighting street to street with these people. We need to go to the halls of power. If you're going to hang somebody, if you're going to burn somebody, burn a politician. They're the ones that are screwing you. Well, they thought that was a little too radical. and they wanted to fight around the bottom. I don't want to fight around the bottom. I want to fight at the top.
What do you mean by burn politicians? Are you speaking metaphorically, or are you talking about setting a match to one?
I'd sure like to see most of the congressmen that are in Washington now taken out and hung from a lamppost.
Is that something that
if I had the power to do it, I'd do it.
And for those who are working for the benefit of the white race, utilizing whatever talents they possess, if they did that, in your opinion, that wouldn't be a bad thing.
No, that wouldn't be a bad thing. As long as they're not just fronts for the big corporations and they're truly wanting to do good for the white people.
So murder in support of the white race is absolutely justifiable.
Yeah, I believe so, sure.
Okay, fair enough. Now, have you ever...
But I don't believe in... people say, well, you believe in violence. I don't believe in ridiculous violence or nonsensical violence.
But murder's okay as long as it's targeted.
Well, it's a... Well, just like the military. It's just like the military. You're on one side, they're on the other, and if it goes into a hot war, you shoot at generals, you don't shoot at the privates.
So you left the Klan because you felt they weren't effective enough. And they weren't effective enough because they were busy being rednecks trying to beat up blacks in back corners, and they weren't willing to take to the halls of power. So you decided to run for Congress yourself, didn't you?
Right. And that's when I, left the Klan, is I said, because you people are not going with the program. Duke had moved on. He was running for office. I was running for office. And I won the Democrat nomination in the largest congressional district in the United States right at the end of when I was a Klan leader.
Well, that's always surprised me, too, because that is such a huge congressional district. How many voters were there in that district at that time?
I don't know the total, but I got 60,000 votes.
Which isn't many, considering how many there are, yet you
I'll take 60,000 people any day.
Comparatively speaking, Tom, I mean, if you were a politician, which you vehemently are not, but in a congressional district that big, I guess my question was, if you could only gather 60,000 of the votes, how were you able to capture the Democratic nomination?
Because I beat out the other people that were running against me. There were two other people running against me on the Democrat ticket.
Okay.
Yeah, and I picked up all the working class votes. In fact, I picked up non-white votes, too. I picked up the Imperial County Mexican Consul. I picked up a lot of the people on the Indian tribe, a lot of people in the Indian tribes and people like that.
Because, why would they vote for you?
Because I was trying to help them out economically. Over in the Imperial Valley, the people were being screwed. The Farm Home Loan Administration was supposed to be loaning out money to families that were making less than 12 grand a year, and I found out that it was corrupt, and none of those people were getting any money, whether they were white or not white. And I exposed that to where these super-duper wealthy Republicans were pocketing millions of dollars and getting millions of dollars in loans, and they weren't paying them back or anything. And I exposed that.
So
The Indians, they were all upset about the illegal aliens tramping across their reservations, and I was super-duper against the illegal alien thing.
Once you lost that bid for state office,
yes,
what tact did your career take at that point?
Well, I had established another group called the White American Political Association at that time, and I was attempting to move the people who had supported me for the campaign and voted for me into a power group that could be purely political. But it didn't work out as well as I thought, and so I bided my time until 82 and ran for U.S. Senate in a field of nine against Jerry Brown and Gore Vidal and a whole bunch of guys. I received 90,000 votes in a statewide election.
Why is it, you suppose, that your idea of the kinder, gentler Klan, if you will, doesn't work? Is it because the people who are drawn to that particular type of organization are really more about the kicking of ass than they are of affecting political change?
Well, that's partly true, but it has to do with leadership. And no matter how much I tried to do one thing, there were other leaders around the country that they just wanted to do it the old way, just rabble-rousing and not going anywhere. So it was sort of like shoveling it against the wind, you know. I couldn't get any place.
Well, you ran your own organization, so you
didn't. Yeah, I did all. No, I did all right, but I didn't. It wasn't something that was going to bring us into the power position we needed. And Duke saw that too, and that's why he left.
So you've kind of come back to that, though, since you've lost the two elections. You've come back to, now you call it a loose association or confederation or whatever it is, but you have done nothing but run organizations since you left off, or since you left the pursuit of office.
Well, I haven't run any organizations. I've just talked to it, administered, advised, and used the internet and used my newspaper and used any means possible to propagandize white people.
Let's talk about your issues with the Southern Poverty Law Center, because now you keep saying that you're head of an association, and but that's not what was apparently proven in court. Tell us a little about that.
Well, Morris Dees, they've been wanting to go after me for years, and I've got the records of that testimony among the SPLC people, and they got themselves a deal there where these people had this fight in the street, and one of the blacks was killed, and there was a young white skinhead that had been roughed up by some other skinheads. He blamed it on me, and he decided to get even, so he went to the Anti-Defamation League, and they put him in touch with Morris Dees, and then Morris Dees groomed him and educated him and trained him to be a witness against me, and he was the only real witness against me in the Portland. And he lied, he perjured himself, and Dees paid him hundreds of dollars a month for several years, even after I went to the Supreme Court.
Why did the Southern Poverty Law Center have such a hard on for you?
Because I was effective. And they knew I hadn't committed any crimes, and they knew I was getting someplace, and they wanted to stop me. They want to stop anybody that starts gaining any power.
Well, but
and
I,
of course, here's the other reason. They want to make a lot of money. He made $7 million off that trial, Morris Dees did, and liberals now are attacking him all over the country. They finally figured out he's got $200 million, and he spends hardly anything. So he wanted to go after me because I was high profile.
Okay, so you're high profile, but the thing is, you've talked about the fact that you don't run any organizations, you have no power, yet this guy is coming after you because you're powerful. Well, there's a disconnect there.
I didn't say I didn't have any power. I'm just saying I use power differently.
What is the power you possess?
Well, it's sort of like a co-op, the farmers in their co-op. They get all the independent farmers together, and they, you know, are like a union. Get all these independent people together, and together they make like a fist. Remember the movie Fist?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Well, the only problem is that when you have a farmer's co-op, they aren't utilizing their fertilizer to blow up federal buildings. They're using it to fertilize the fields.
Well, I don't know whether you've read much about the history of this country, but in the late 1900s and the late 1800s, early 1900s, the farmers were blowing up a lot of things because you had the various groups, the Molly Maguires, you had the Matuan uprising, you had the Pullman strike, you had all the white labor rising up against the government and other people. This nation has a history of extreme violence.
Have you ever committed violence?
Only in my self-defense. I mean, I've had four attempts on my life. One was a contract killing that they didn't get pulled off. One was a man who stood up when I was at a Democrat Central Committee meeting. He stood up with a 25 automatic and tried to kill me, and like that.
Who put a contract on your life?
It was actually a drug gang because I was against drugs and using the Klan to fight drugs. And they decided that I was a problem. But luckily, the guy they gave the job to didn't do it. He said he liked me, so he went to the police and they thwarted this thing.
They thwarted it because he gave himself up primarily.
No, he didn't give himself up. He just told them what was going on and they stopped it.
I see.
And they warned me about it.
So tell me a little something about the Turner Diaries for our guests who are unfamiliar with it. What is the book, The Turner Diaries?
Turner Diaries is a fictional book about the overthrow of the government of the United States. It's simply a fiction book. It's not a manual. I heard Tom Layden talking about on your show. Some people might think it's a manual, but if you went by that manual, you wouldn't last very long. And, of course, I'm 100% against nuclear weapons being dropped on anybody. I would never use a nuclear weapon on populations.
Well, yeah, the previous guest did say that if you had the opportunity, you would detonate nuclear weapons. So that's just,
no.
I write a lot.
Well, you can check my history. I was even against any nuking of Russia. My and the right wing attacked me viciously because I said if the United States and Russia go to war with nuclear war, you will destroy the whole northern hemisphere, the homelands of all the white people. And I said, no, I'm totally against that. See, I'm against the big corporate wars. I resisted the Vietnam War and lost my house for a while for doing it. I was against Reagan in Central America. I was against the Cold War and the possibility of nuking white Russia and all that. You see, I believe maybe in individual combat and tribal combat, but I don't believe in these big wars like the government gets involved in.
So you believe in operating much like Al-Qaeda does, where you work in these small individual cells so that there's not a central power structure and that those with the gifts can utilize their gifts for the overthrow of the present power structure, right?
Well, that's as old as history. I mean, the unconventional warfare. What do you think the Sons of Liberty were in 1776? They worked their regular jobs, and a lot of them were involved in secret groups that were going around burning out the Tories and so forth and like that. So
is that a yes, Tom? Is that a yes? You operate the same way that Al-Qaeda does.
Unconventional warfare is a very effective means for poor people to resist strong people.
So it is a good idea to blow up the occasional federal building or to shoot a police officer. That's what I'm hearing, Tom. Is that the message I should be
saying? I'm saying in the furtherance of resistance to a central power that is dictatorial and oppressive.
Which the United States government is, right?
If you must use violence, you probably would be best to use that kind of violence. But I have said as long as I have free speech and free assembly and freedom of moving around, I am not saying I'm going out and blow up anything.
You're not saying that you are. But if other
people telling anybody to.
But if
it's
not necessarily a bad idea, because what Tim McVeigh did wasn't a bad idea.
Everybody does what they feel needs to be done. If someone feels like Timothy McVeigh to do that, he did that. He took the responsibility and he paid the price. Everybody's responsible for their own actions. I'm responsible for my actions.
So then if someone who doesn't agree with your particular philosophy decides to do what these drug dealers did and put a bullet in your brain, then they're justified in doing that because everybody's responsible for their own actions then. Is that right?
Well, they're responsible for their own actions, and they went to jail for 40 years for trying it, too. I mean, of course, you got to pay the price. If I fail, you know, Cooley's masterful work on constitutional law says that everyone has the right to commit revolution, but the state also has the right to hang you if you don't succeed.
So should there be any law at all, Tom? Because what you're espousing is anarchy. You claim that you're fighting fascism, but you're espousing basically anarchy or law of the jungle. Is that what I'm hearing? I don't think so.
Well, I don't think so. I think that the way this nation first was formed, where you had states and they had states' rights and they had pretty much freedom in these colonies and so forth, that I wouldn't call that anarchy. But I will say this. I have sympathies with anarchists. I've studied all their books and everything. I think that the anarchist idea is far better than the strong super dictatorial state. If I have to make a choice, I'd choose anarchy.
And anarchy takes the form of whatever means necessary.
Well, I believe that's the way it is. With governments, it's by any means necessary. So, I mean, yeah, whatever the government does, I think the individual should be able to do too.
He should be
prepared to pay the price. If we lose, we get it. Timothy McVeigh got caught, and he paid the price.
Now, if he hadn't gotten caught, what would have been accomplished there, in your opinion?
Well, unfortunately, the way the propaganda is in this country, nothing much happened. I mean, just a lot of people died. I don't think Timothy McVeigh realized how stupid the American people are. And when they hit the trade building in New York City, they still are stupid, because these people reacted the only way they know how. We built a big air base in Saudi Arabia, and the Islamic people didn't want it there. They asked to get it out of there. They didn't get it out of there, so they came over here and blew up those buildings.
So, again,
I'm not advocating it, but I understand it. That's called unconventional warfare.
Well, that's like the old adage, I don't condone white beating, but I do understand it.
There's plenty of attorneys would say that. Attorneys would say, well, I understand it. I'm not going to do it, but I understand it. I think you do have to understand a lot of things that you may not be prepared to do.
At least not
prepared to do it at this moment.
Is Aryan equatable with Nazi?
Well, Aryan was around a long time before anybody ever heard of a Nazi. It's a concept.
But that's not what is associated with now.
Well, no, well, of course not, because it was associated with Hitler, so it's used all the time in that sense. But
so why did you choose the word?
Well, because it's a true description of a people of history, of white people in Europe and down through history has been the offspring of an Aryan group of people.
But you didn't call it the Australopithecine resistance movement. You called it the Aryan resistance movement, and there's obviously a reason for that. There has to be.
I'll tell you one reason I called it that was to piss off the Jews.
Okay, that's that. All I'm asking for is a little truth, Tom. I'm not going to censor anything you say, but let's cut to the BS. Yeah, okay.
You want to piss off the Jews?
Tell me about that.
I knew if I put Aryan in the word, and of course it fit. You know, I was going to call it White American Resistance, and I said, well, that's a little mild. Let's piss off the Jews, and I'll put Aryan in there. And I knew the minute I put that in there, they'd go nuts.
So now we know that you don't care for black people, you don't care for Jews.
Wait a minute. I know all kinds of black people. I don't hate black people. I just want separation of the races.
Okay, well, we need to be separated.
And Jews, there are Jews and then there are Jews. I mean, you got AIPAC, which is made up of these war hawks that want to blow everybody up. And then you've got Joe Blow Goldstein driving a cab. That's an entirely different story.
Then let me ask you, Tom, is it primarily a socioeconomic thing that you're talking about as opposed to race?
Along with the race. See, if a civil war starts in this country, which it ultimately will, it will be started by economics. It won't be started by race. But then after economic upheaval starts, then the racism thing will kick in. It always does. Or tribalism, if you will.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Audio Martini. Our guest tonight is Tom Metzger, self-avowed racist, head of white area or Aryan insurgents. The economic part, though, that I'm talking about, Tom, is you seem to have no problem with folks of other races who are in your comfort level, who are in your same economic status and that sort of thing. If I'm hearing you right, you're
right,
saying... So why do we need to be separated from the good guys?
Because we're biologically different. Beyond economics, we are biologically different.
Ah, you got to explain that to me, buddy. How are we biologically different?
Well, let's say you take a country that's totally populated and run and led by black people. And then you look at a country that's totally white and led by white people and compare them.
So you don't believe in DNA testing that says there is no difference whatsoever among the races other than the amount of melanin in the skin. You don't buy the science of it.
I don't buy that science. That's political science. It started out with Ashley Montague.
No, it's not political science. That's...
Yeah, it is political science.
No, that's horse crap, Tom.
Well,
it's
no,
real
the one...
And the point is that that's science that you don't buy.
What about this Nobel Prize winner that tried to say a little bit something negative about the black race, and they almost I thought they was going to hang him. That was only a couple of months ago.
Tell us who that guy was. Tell us specifically about that event there, Tom.
I don't remember the whole story,
precisely.
But it was a...
Precisely.
I think... Well, I can't tell you precisely because...
Because it's a non-event, Tom.
It was headlines. This terrible Nobel laureate had said something about the wonderful black race, and we got to get him, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's plenty of people who feel the way I do, and they're a lot smarter about it than I am, that they're not going to come out and lose their career, lose their jobs, because anything you say now that has anything to do with inequality, people go crazy.
Tom, why is it that any time there is any, quote, evidence presented for this stuff, that it can never be adequately quoted? I mean, this is your job, after all. So if you're going to use evidence of superiority of a race, then shouldn't you at least be able to quote it accurately? And
I don't even have to do it. I do it by observation. I go to a black neighborhood, a black urban area, and then I go to an all-white urban area and just sit there and watch the people.
So you're kind of the Dianne Fossey of hate mongers.
It's just like going to the zoo. I mean, you watch the animals and you see the way different animals act. I mean, you know, I've always depended on observation. I don't need a scientist to tell me that down in the Congo, they operate a hell of a lot differently than they do out here in Montana.
Well, see, Tom, and that's why does it take 45 minutes to get down to the plain boil fact that Tom Metzger don't like niggers and he don't like Jews? Why does it take 45 minutes to get to that fact?
I just said let the black people have their countries. I don't want to oppress them or steal off of them or anything. They can be whatever they want to be and go as high as they want to be, like Booker T. Washington tried to help them out. And that has nothing to do with hating them. It's understanding them,
I see. So why is it that...
Now, if you're talking about a black...
Why is
now,
it
if you're talking
team?
About a... If
go
you're
ahead.
Talking... If you're talking about a black person that's out here raping and butchering white girls and things like that, of course I hate him. But I've sat down with people from Louis Farrakhan's organization before. I've spoken before them, and I've been a speaker before the Panther Party and so forth like that. We got along okay.
Yeah, because they're all nuts. I mean, realistically, Tom, what happens when we have all... First of all, how do we divvy out who gets what land? How do we figure that out?
Well, I tried to start working on that way back in the 80s, and I went all over the country meeting with all these different separatist groups of blacks, different black groups, and other groups, and I thought we were getting somewhere, but it never got anywhere. It fell apart. So what's going to happen is the natural... struggle is going to come about, and there's nothing I can do to start it, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. There will be a racial struggle on this continent.
And who's going to win it?
I don't know. The way white people act today, I don't think whites are going to win it.
So
I don't think they have enough balls to win anything.
So you have contempt for your own race, it sounds like. Why are you fighting so difficult, or why are you fighting so hardly for something that seems to be inferior, in your opinion?
Because there's a percentage of white people that have not bought into the crap and are worth saving, and they will be the nucleus to build something new. Phoenix Rising. We can lose two-thirds of our race and still end up back on top.
Well, couldn't you say the same thing about other races? Because you talked about the Jewish cab driver and the good black guy from Missouri. So what if you wiped out the two-thirds or culled out their genetic weakness, as you're describing it? Why wouldn't they be just as good as you?
Well, you're talking about the Jews as a race. The Jews are not a race, so
then let's talk about blacks. Let's talk about Mexicans. If they called out the weaklings, as you're describing, you calling out the weaklings among the Aryans, why wouldn't they be a perfectly acceptable race of people?
Because their genetic makeup and their IQ is just not going to make it to the general level of the white race.
Upon what science do you base that?
I don't have to base it on any science. I just watch them, listen to them, and see what they produce. Now, when's the last time you were able to buy a car manufactured in the Congo?
When were you able to buy a car manufactured in the United States? Toyota is number two. So does that mean that the Asians are superior to us?
The Asians are very sharp people, and they may be sharper than we are. And I have no problem dealing with the Asian people because they have the Chinese, the Koreans, and the Japanese. I have toured in Japan. I've spoken to 500 businessmen and military leaders at a time in Japan a few years ago. I got along fine over there.
Okay, so you got along fine among 400 or 500. See, that's the central part of this. You can find 400 or 500 people who download hippopotamus porn on the internet. But that doesn't mean that you have some sort of national movement, Tom.
I didn't say I did. I'm just one guy. I'm Johnny Appleseed out there planting my seeds, and I was received very well in Japan by some very powerful people.
Well, okay, Mr. Appleseed, we've got about 30 seconds left together here. I'm going to give you that last 30 to take us home.
Okay, it's been fun. Well, anyhow, I think that we should deal by observation. I believe in homogeneous countries. I don't believe that the white race needs anything the black race has to offer. I think the black race has benefited absolutely stupendously by being associated with white people. If we went to Mars, black people would try to follow us there because they just always want to get into the act. But I would say black leaders, lead your own countries, and I'll respect your territorial bounds, and we can have trade and everything else, but you're causing too much trouble in this country.